Pod Week. Episode, I believe this is episode number 6 now. Episode 5 has mysteriously disappeared. So those of you who are looking for episode 5, as soon as I can find it, we will release it, but it has grown legs and walked away. So here we are with episode 6. And episode 6, we have a wonderful guest, Brian Moon. Brian works at Deal News. Say hi, Brian.
Hello, everybody.
And for the longest time, Brian, I thought it was Dealer News. I don't know why, but it's just, you know, it just hit me the other day, and I went out to y'all's site, and it's a really cool site, but it's a lot cooler than Dealer News. So,
yeah, Dealer News. Yeah. Dealer News is something different.
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, Brian, no discussion with you can start without noting that Brian was there at PHP Appalachia. The second one there at the cabins. You guys rented one of the cabins for your team, which I thought was really awesome. And I also thought it was really awesome that you guys were sober enough to drive me to the hospital because nobody in the hot tub was. So.
Yeah, we learned a valuable lesson that day, which was be drunk first.
Yeah. So, if I haven't said so lately, thank you for that. So, anyhow, and as always, my unindicted co-conspirator, Keith Casey. Say hi, Keith.
Hi, Keith. How are you guys?
Awesome, awesome. Couldn't even get a sip in between there. Keith.
Personally, I'm impressed that Brian still talks to all of us after PHP Appalachia. I mean, that I'm sincerely amazed by that. So, That seriously calls Brian's judgment into question, in my opinion.
For those of you who are now frantically Googling, only about 90% of the rumors about PHP Appalachia in Gatlinburg are actually true. The other 10% are absolutely false. So
there was
unfortunately,
a stabbing.
Those are the rumors that we actually got things done there.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a great time, but to call that a conference is really stretching the word conference. And I will say this, though. It was one of the best networking experiences that I've ever had with the PHP community. I mean, I got to know so many people there and got to spend some quality time. Of course, you know, if you can't do anything else because you can't walk on a foot, you sit around and talk to people. So anyhow. Our topic tonight is DevOps, and I will preface this by saying I've done IT management, and I have consulted with companies on IT management, and it always amazes me how many companies do not understand the basic principles that we're going to discuss tonight. And the reason Brian is on is last week he wrote a blog post on how they do it at Deal News, and I'm reading this going, absolutely everybody, every developer and every developer manager should read this because this is just important information. Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about your setup? And actually, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Keith because, you know, Keith, you're usually running these things. I'll let you two talk about it and I'll just interject when necessary. So, Brian, take it away.
Okay. Well, at Deal News, we were a startup in 1997. So we kind of grew up with the web in a lot of ways. So a lot of the ways that we do things are just what made sense for our team. And as it turns out, 13 years later, there's a name for it, and it's been named DevOps. And basically the idea is the development team and operations work together. Their job responsibilities are tied together to enable the business to succeed. And so it's not that developers write code and operations is responsible for making servers work. It's, you know, and that they're not connected, but it's all under one umbrella. And that's just the way our team grew organically over the years. And now that there's a lot of interest in it now. I'm lucky to be someone who's been doing that for a very long time.
So Brian, how big is your team currently, just headcount wise?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.5. We've got an intern. So right now we've got that's developers and operations is 6.5 people.
What's the breakdown between the two? And it sounds like there's some there's definitely some overlap in collaboration. What's the general breakdown in that 6.5?
Yeah, so we have one dedicated, fully dedicated operations position, whose day in day out job is you know, operations related things. We have, and then we have, you know, myself. I'm involved with architecture planning and things of that nature. So that's sort of operations, but at the same time, it's so blended with us. It's everything has been so blended with us from the beginning that it's almost hard to say how much of my job is architecture and how much of it, I mean, how much of it is operations and how much of it is development. That goes for our two most senior people, pretty much fit in that category. I mean, our two most senior developers, you know, according to, you know, our job titles were literally in our racks today in Atlanta installing servers. So we're very, very integrated in that sort of way. We do have two developers who are more, you know, I'd say 80% developer, but then again, one of those developers, it has all the responsibilities of managing our Asterisk phone system, right from the hardware to you know, deploying the phones to everything. So, it's a very blended, it's a very, very blended company.
Yeah, it sounds like there are definitely very few walls or barriers between those. And Deal News might be unique in this regard. So how big is Deal News as a whole? 6.5 developers, ops people, how many total across the entire organization?
We have about 45 full-time employees and another 5 to 10 part-time or contractor employees in the company.
Oh, wow.
In, I think, 17 states.
Brian, I've got a question for you.
Sure.
Since you are a blended environment, how does this impact your hiring? Is it more difficult to find? Are you more picky about them? Or do you just try to find somebody and train them up the way you want them?
You know, that's a great question. It is tough to find someone who has been in that environment, because it's not an environment. It's not a traditional environment at all. I had tweeted a while back that the reason that DevOps is gaining ground as sort of a methodology now is because the people who were young and had to make the internet work with whatever they could in the late 90s are now 13-year senior engineers in charge, you know, and that's the way they did things. That's how they had to do things in the late 90s. And so that's the way they've continued to evolve. So there's not a lot of people who have come up in that environment. We've been pretty lucky to find people who had had an eye for understanding how systems work. We mostly have hired developers who understood how systems work. One of our most recent hires, we've tried to hire operations people who understood how software development works. So because we've tried that latest position of being a full-time ops position is one where we wanted someone who focused more on ops, whereas ops has been, you know, very, very shared up till now. It is really hard. We had to be really, really selective in our hiring process. And it is tough to find.
So getting into what your actual process is, I've read the article a couple times now, but let's go ahead and start it off. Everything is an SVN. Is that true?
Yes.
Everything?
I can't think of anything that's not an SVN. I mean, all of our PHP code, all of our Apache configurations, our DNS information is stored in SVN. Right down to, I mean, the if someone writes a script, you know, then if someone writes a script that they just use on their local machine for just to make their life easier, we stick that in SVN because another developer may want to use it. Yeah, I mean, we try to keep everything in SVN, and it makes deploying things very easy, because all we have to do is do a checkout, and we can do a checkout on the server, or sometimes we check out on a central server and rsync the changes around. Yeah.
Now you said a little while ago that you've got the 6.5 people out of 45 people in the whole organization, but you mentioned 17 different states. Is your development team all in one office?
The majority of them are. I work from home a good bit. I'm a couple hours away from our home office, and we have another developer who is in and out of the office. But it's something that it's not. We all try to get together on a regular basis, but it's not something where we're all sitting in the same office together every day. No, we use XMPP chat for a lot of our communication.
So it seems like the potential for conflicts and problems could happen there. How do you guys handle specifically code conflicts and merges and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, when you get SVN conflicts, you just have to work them out. For the most part, it's not that big of a problem. Everything goes into trunk. So when someone is committing, if they have conflicts, they just have to resolve those conflicts as they're committing. And it doesn't come up as often as you would fear. It doesn't come out nearly as often as it did back when we were a very young company and we were all trying to edit the same code base on a Samba share. That really caused a lot of problems.
You're saying just editing things directly is bad?
Well, okay, that wasn't directly on live servers, but it was all on a Samba share on a dev server. This is like 99, 2000.
So you're saying not using version control is a bad idea?
It's a very bad idea.
Oh, yeah. Dude, okay. No.
Okay. Just clarifying that.
I was talking with the lovely and talented Kathy this week, and because we were on vacation, and as late as February, they were the company that she is now working for were editing live files on a live server using FTP, and one person would FTP up their changes, and the next person would FTP up their changes, and then there would be a WTF moment because the first changes were gone, you know. So, as much as we like to joke, that stuff still goes on.
Yeah, we did some of that in 98, but 99 maybe, but we quickly got away. If that happens a few dozen times to you and it really gets old. I think we started using SVN. I guess we started heavily using SVN in 2003.
That's pretty early for SVN.
It was really early for SVN.
Yeah.
We didn't use we hated CVS. I hated CVS.
Who doesn't?
And so we never really I think we installed CVS like three times and thought about, hey, let's start using it, and then something would happen and we'd be like, ah, I hate that. So we became actually SVN was, well, I first used it, the open source project I started called Forum. We started using SVN in really early SVN, and I loved it. So DealNews, we quickly started using it at DealNews as well.
So wait, as a quick side point, the stuff that, like, the tips and the tools and the tricks and stuff that you learned doing your open source project, you brought into your organization?
Oh, that happens on a regular basis.
Okay. Just,
yeah. Yeah. No, that,
just,
I mean, I would
clarify that point.
Hey, I got my job offer. The way I actually got involved with this company was, I knew the founders, but other than that, they needed a message board, and so I started writing one in PHP and MySQL, and it took off. And then my official job offer was, do you want to just work on that forum software all day, every day? It was open source software. And so I was hired to basically bring that up to speed and make it faster and better. I spent the first 6 months working for DealNews, just working on that open source software.
Sweet.
Good deal.
We still run that up. We run that software still on the site. So, it's a regular, I learn things working on open source software that I then apply to DealNews. That happens on a regular basis.
All right. So we covered what you guys do locally. So you've got SVN, you have your local environments and everything. And then there's production. Do you guys just deploy directly to production? No testing whatsoever?
No. For the first part of testing is making sure that the developer's environment is as similar to production as possible. So in production, we use Gentoo Linux and on 64-bit processors. And so our development environment is all Gentoo development environment with 64-bit, you know, running AMD 64 Gentoo. And so that's all very, very, you know, very, very homogeneous for production. And so it starts there. The Apache configuration is we actually take our production Apache configuration and retrofit it as little as possible to work on a, you know, sort of local host, not a local host, but on a single IP host environment. And, you know, we try to keep it as similar to production as possible. And so that's the first step. The second step is everybody checks in the trunk eventually, and that will then be tested on a staging server. The staging servers go ahead.
What does your testing look like? Is it click around? Is it how advanced do you get with that unit testing?
Now, we don't really do like Selenium type testing at this point. It's something I really like to try to get into, and it may be around the corner for us. But right now, it is mostly we do micro changes, so we don't make, you know, 150 commits, 200 commits, and then roll out a version of our code. So we get a ticket to make a one feature request to one application in our stack, you know, in what we have, and we make that one change, and that developer rolls that one change. So testing that one change is fairly contained. We have situations where things like unit testing and Selenium probably would help us better find where we have unintended consequences, where we make a change to a library function that turns out that the quirk that we thought was a bug in that function is actually being manipulated and used by someone else's code. But for the most part, it usually involves, if it's a super minor change, you know, like 5-10 lines, the developer will see it through. If it's more than that, they will normally get another developer involved. And if it's something that affects our front page, or one of our busiest pages, or the content creation tools that our content staff uses, those changes will actually be checked out and looked at and looked over by someone on the content team before it rolls.
So you have some sort of code review step in there.
Yeah, yeah. It's not an official code review step. It's our culture, I guess, is the way to put it. Like when we make tickets, we have a custom field and track that marks a ticket whether or not this needs approval by the content team before it goes off. All right. So when the ticket is created, that is marked, and so you can't roll this to production unless someone in content team has signed off on it. So we have those type of things in place.
Okay. So, but you said micro changes, and you're talking about a 5-10 lines of code. How many deployments do you make on a given week or a given month? How often are you making updates to the production sites?
Well, let me see. I'll pull up track and tell you. Let's see. Yesterday we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We had 14 rolls to production yesterday.
Wait, 14 yesterday?
Yeah, 12 the day before. Yeah.
Like this is during a pretty standard business day, like 9 to 5, 9 to 6 sort of time, right?
Yes.
So if you're doing, just to make the math easy, if you're doing 12 a day, you're doing like one every 40, 45 minutes.
Yep. I mean, there's days when it may be only five. There may be days when it's only five.
Only five? Holy crap.
I have quarters where I may do only five, usually. That's an incredible amount. Of course, it speaks to the strength of your system, but oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, it's... Yeah, that's the way we do it.
Wow.
So we prefer making lots of small changes to making large changes. So that's just sort of one of our philosophy.
Wow, hats off to you. That's impressive. I mean, and I get making small changes makes a lot of sense, because then if how often do you guys have to roll back? It sounds like on a given week you could make, 30 to 100 production rollouts. How often do you have to roll back in those?
We hardly ever roll back. We much prefer to roll forward, which means if we do roll and there is a bug, usually the one of the nice things about, which I haven't gotten to the full rolling to production sort of concept yet, but the developer who makes the change rolls to production and is responsible for making sure production works after they roll.
Tell us about that. How do they, a developer has their changes, some content person has gone ahead and signed off on it, and some sanity check has happened. You've started the testing. That all comes through. How does it then go to production?
So on the staging server, the staging servers have a checkout of the production branch. So we merge using a merge tool we wrote ourselves from our trunk into this production branch on our staging servers. And after everything checks out there, when we commit that branch, we commit those changes in the production branch there. Then the developer, using a restricted account, logs into a single server in our production facility where the production branch is checked out there as well. They update that checkout. And if there's no conflicts or anything looks weird about the checkout, it looks like they expect, they sync those changes. It all actually happens with a make file we've written, but basically it uses rsync. And it synchronizes those changes out to all of our 45 or 50 servers.
Wow.
It does it in a set order to make sure that the files that need to be in place first are in place first. So the developer who made the change does that job. And then once that is done, it is their responsibility for whatever application they were working on, whether it's an internal application or a public-facing application, to then actually check the production systems to make sure that the change took and is working the way they expected it to. If there is, for some reason, an unforeseen bug or unforeseen change that is not catastrophic, and they can quickly know what they messed up, which with this type of rollout system, I don't know how to speak to it any other way than experience. That's basically when we do that and there turns out there is some minor flaw, they immediately go, oh, I know exactly what that is. And within a minute, they can have that changed and pushed back through the whole system again. Rather than rolling back, we roll forward with fixing whatever we broke.
And I guess that's one of the strengths of the micro changes, in that since only a very, very small subsection of code has changed, there's not many places the bug can be, right?
Right. Yeah. And when I'm talking about micro changes, like if you make a change to a library function that already exists, we favor going ahead and rolling that function separate from like whatever the feature you're adding. So you're working on a new feature and you need to make a small change to a library function that we've got written. You'll make the change to the library function and roll that library function through on its own. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that way you can see the effects of just that change all the way through the process. And then if that goes well, then you go back to making your feature that you need. And now that is all handled. Whatever you needed that library function to do is now rolled all the way through to production and known to be working. It's one of those things, when I say it, I can understand where people hear what I'm saying and think, you're full of crap. You guys have just got to be cowboys who are, just doing things off the seat of your pants. But You know, I think we have literally only actually rolled back SVN changes 3 times.
Wow.
Three times. When? Like ever?
Yeah. Like only 3 times have we ever just said, okay, we just need to roll that back. You know, and that was usually when it was a big change and it was a pretty big, you know, like a front page issue, you know, type of thing.
Hey, Brian, I've got a question for you because this always comes up when you're doing major changes. And since you're doing a lot of little changes, I'm sure you've got a solution for this already. How do you handle database modifications?
Yeah, those are fun. if it's a major change, like if you're adding a key to a, you know, 12 million row table or 40 million row table, something that's going to basically lock the table, we try to do those off hours, you know.
Right. But what about structure changes? You're adding a field or you're changing a field or something like that. I know those don't happen, or at least changing fields don't happen often, but I've seen it happen. You do it during the off hours, but do you have a step in your rollout process that says if database changes are necessary, they are done here?
Yeah, they would be done at each step. They're done before, before the code's run, but before the code is rolled. So at the staging point, we would roll database changes to the staging database servers, and then the code would roll. The database changes pretty much have to roll before the code can roll, or else, you know, the code just doesn't work. We hardly ever, maybe once or twice, have ever dropped a field from a table. And you know, that would mostly be taken care of in some sort of refactoring where we were sort of totally rethinking the application. But we don't, as far as changing, you know, the only changes that really happen that can cause problems are in MySQL, if you're changing an enum column, you know, that requires basically a full rewrite of the table.
That's true. And
they're kind of nasty. So if we actually, on any table we think is going to have any considerable size, we try to avoid enums. It's not ideal. We end up doing more validation in code at our, you know, object mapping than we would like to. But just for performance reasons, if we ever need to alter that table, we don't have to alter the table when we add a new, you know, value for that enum.
A couple questions for you. I haven't heard a few keywords in here, like pre-commit hooks, post-commit hooks. Do you do any of that in SVN?
We have commit hooks for sending out emails. Not for doing logs. Yeah, and we also have we don't do any code modification for commit hooks or anything like that. We don't have anything automated in terms of with commit hooks, in terms of actually dealing with the code or moving the code around or altering the code or anything like that. We use the make file we use that rolls our code out to our nodes, uses our XMPP bot that we wrote to notify everyone that code was just rolled. So those 14 times a day when code is rolled, everyone is notified every single time. Everybody on the DevOps team is notified that code was just rolled via an instant message.
Nifty.
So, yeah, so it keeps everybody sort of in the loop.
So the other question I have, and obviously this is a hot topic, but distributed version control systems like Git, Bazaar, Mercurial, any of those, have you guys played with any of those? Have you considered using one of those?
For Deal News, no, because we like developing on trunk. and sort of keeping everybody on the same. I don't want to say forces, but it just sort of makes sure everybody is sort of working in the same code base, where with those distributed systems, you can get out of date pretty quick if you don't keep, pulling in changes. And I think those are really, really good for, those are really good for distributed development, where the project has, you know, lots of different maintainers with lots of different interests who want to, want to propose changes, which I use GitHub and I use Launchpad for some open source projects, and they work great for those projects, but it's not really for a contained development team, I think, like us.
Okay. Hey, Brian, I got a question for you. We've been talking tech and about how you do everything. What does Deal News actually do, though? I mean, what's the product that y'all sell?
So Deal News is a website where we find and list 200 to 300 great deals on different products and services that our content team researches every deal. And finds, you know, from televisions to, shirts to pants to anything, you know, shoes, laptops, anything. And we're unique in a lot of ways in our space because every single thing we list is researched very, very thoroughly and confirmed before we post it. And, So that's, you know, they do 200 to 300 of those a day. And, our technology is to, the reason we make our technology is to enable our content team, to deliver that content every day.
Awesome. And of course, I've got to ask, since I know we've, at least I'm hoping we have several PHP developers listening to this. I know my mom listens. Hi, Mom. Other than that, I'm really hoping we've got PHP people listening. Do you currently have any open positions? Because quite honestly, Deal News sounds like from what you've described and what I know about it from my own research and from talking with people, you know, it sounds like an awesome company to work for. Do you have any open billets?
We currently have a couple of openings. There's several. You could go to dealnews.com/jobs, and everything is there.
Okay, and I'll put a link to that in our show notes. So hopefully both people that listen other than my mom will go out and click on it.
My mom doesn't even listen.
My mom will when I tell her I'm on it.
Ah, hey, that works. She's a strong PHP developer?
No.
Oh,
no, she doesn't understand half of what I say, but she just likes hearing her little boy on, the internet. So, she reads my blog, but doesn't know what it's about.
And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Brian, I can't thank you enough. This is a topic that I find very interesting, and I loved your blog post, a link to which will be, of course, in the show notes. Keith, thanks a lot. I know you just took a red eye in this morning from the coast, and I hope you go get some sleep now. Sleep. What's that? For those of you who have not got your tickets, there are still a few tickets left for Tech 10. Join us in Chicago, May 18th through the 21st. Tech 10 is where smart people meet interesting ideas, and we're all going to be there, and it's going to be a fun time. It's going to be more than PHP Appalachia is. You know, PHP Appalachia was all about, well, let's just call it networking, but Tech 10 is much more about learning, and there's still a lot of networking. The friends you make at these conferences are – the relationships you build are invaluable. So join us there. You'll see a link to it in the show notes. That's all I've got, guys. I appreciate you being here with us, and we will see y'all all online.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. Much appreciated.
Enjoyed it.
Odd Week Podcast is a production of Blue Parabola. It is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative 3.0 license. This means you can share it all you like, but please don't fold, spindle, or mutilate. Keith Casey can be found wandering the intertube around the Washington, D.C. area on any given day. If you can't find him, you can always check his blog, caseysoftware.com. Cal Evans, on the other hand, is usually hiding in his secret lair in Nashville, Tennessee. However, you can track his every movement at his blog, blog.calevans.com. Since you love the podcast, and we know you did, why not trade us your email address for our show notes? If you do, after each episode, we'll send you the links we discuss, we'll apologize for the bad humor, and we'll explain any inside jokes. To subscribe to the show notes mailing list, visit phparch.com/podcast. The Odd Week theme music is Iceman by Dr. Blue and is released under a Creative Commons license. A link to the album can be found in the show notes.
Yeah, we learned a valuable lesson that day, which was be drunk first.